if you start a new program or you increase that program, how do you continue to fund it if you don't get federal funds?
State leaders dig into the details of the federal stimulus proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 2nd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Juneau gets its hydro power back online.
We were just a few days away from getting the repairs complete, and we kept having these weather delays, and so that was very frustrating knowing we were generating diesel just for the weather.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
Governor Palin and the presiding officers of the House and Senate are joining forces to present their arguments against the federal economic stimulus package that is currently before the Senate. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Palin told Anchorage television station KTUU over the weekend that the letter from her and the legislature would go to members of Congress to show concerns with what's been put before them. She says she's worried that the federal plan and the federal deficit would create expanded social programs and unfunded mandates for the state. The stimulus plan is scheduled to be before the U.S. Senate the rest of this week. Alaska's House Speaker Mike Chenault says that he and Senate President Gary Stevens are working on the letter with Palin's staff. However, he says the details haven't been worked out.
As the economic stimulus package changes, it seems like it is on the hour, by the hour, certainly, you know, that letter may be crafted to a different standard at that time, but certainly we're working with the administration trying to formulate a position that Alaska will have on some of the issues that we've heard about in the stimulus package.
In a printed statement over the weekend, Palin said she wanted to be certain that Alaska and other states be treated fairly, adding that spending on government programs, quote, would be a burden on states to continue funding. She said the federal plan does not spend enough that would stimulate the economy by putting people back to work. Chenault says increased funding for formula programs needs to be brought into the national debate.
If you have a formula program that does nothing more than increase the cost of state government, and certainly it may help out this year, but what if you start a new program or you increase that program, how do you continue to fund it if you don't get federal funds? And so I think that there are some areas that we should be interested in and concerned about as far as the increase of some of these funding formula programs that we may have to pick up the cost for in future years.
Legislative resolutions addressing Alaska's concerns are scheduled to open tomorrow in Juneau. House Minority Leader Beth Krutula says she hopes the final letter doesn't turn into a political statement on any particular issue. And she also doubts that the federal package will overburden the state in future years.
This is where we do get into some arguments about, well, which program is it? There may be some that are totally valid that we're going to want to take advantage of. So I wouldn't start out negatively. I guess that's what I'm saying. I want to take advantage of every federal dollar I can for Alaska. We do not want to fall into a depression. And if we have the opportunity to save Alaska before we even have felt the major problem, then I want to take advantage of that. I want to figure out how to do that, and I want to do it in a smart, nonpartisan way.
The stimulus plan is the major topic for debate this week in the U.S. Senate. Congressional leaders say they hope that differences between the Senate plan and the version the House has already passed will be before President Obama by February 13th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The House Energy Committee is going on the road this month. Charisse Millett has scheduled meetings in Kotzebue and Nome this weekend and in Dillingham and Bethel the last weekend of the month. Millett says she wants to sit down with the residents of those communities, and she thinks it's important to listen to them.
We're going to take some trips to some wind farms in Kotzebue and Nome. We're also going to try and visit Noatak, which is the highest energy cost in that region, and talk to those residents about how they're making it, how they're doing it, what the state and the legislature can do to help them. if anything, at this point.
The formal hearings this weekend are tentatively planned for 1 o'clock Saturday in Kotzebue at the Assembly Chambers and at 1 Sunday in Nome at Old St. Joe's Church. Details on the Dillingham and Bethel hearings are not yet available. The Associated Press is reporting a second former staffer to Congressman Don Young, Fraser Verusio, has been implicated in the Jack Abramoff influence peddling investigation. Identified in federal court papers only as Staffer D, Verusio is said to have accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to Game 1 of the 2003 World Series from lobbyists who wanted his help. Two attorneys familiar with the case said Monday that Staffer D is Verusio, who was policy director on the Transportation Committee for about 5 years. The attorney spoke on condition of anonymity because of the ongoing investigation. Paul Rauser, an attorney for Verusio, didn't immediately return a call, and a Justice Department spokeswoman declined comment. The trip to the World Series in 2003 has already helped prosecutors win guilty pleas from three people: Trevor Blacken, a former aide to two Missouri Republicans, and former Abramoff lobbying associates James Herney and Todd Bollinger. Bollinger and Herney helped provide the World Series trip. Court papers say Blacken and Verusio were the recipients and were treated to a chauffeured SUV, dinner at an expensive steakhouse, and a visit to a strip club. A plea deal Bollinger accepted Friday states the purpose of the lavish trip was in part to influence Verusio and Blacken to help an equipment rental company win favorable language in a highway bill. Mark Zacharias, another former Young aide, pleaded guilty to conspiracy in April 2007. Zacharias acknowledged accepting gifts and a golf trip to Scotland from Abramoff's team in exchange for official acts on their behalf. Young's spokeswoman did not immediately return a call for comment today. Juneau is back on hydroelectric power after an avalanche tore down the Snettisham power line on January 12th. Alaska Electric Light and Power crews finished repairs to the line yesterday afternoon. Generally, 100% of Juneau's power comes from hydroelectric facilities at a cost of just more than 10 cents a kilowatt hour. More expensive diesel fuel is the emergency backup. With hydro back on, the company will determine how much diesel was used while the line was down and ask the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to approve a temporary rate hike to pay for the high-cost fuel. AELNP generation engineer Scott Willis estimates an increase of about 15 cents a kilowatt hour over a period of a month. Last month's avalanche was the second in 9 months to damage the Snettisham line. While Willis says sometimes natural disasters really are just that, professional avalanche forecasters have been monitoring and controlling snow slides along the line since November, but the snow that knocked down the transmission structure was a natural release on a foggy day that prevented crews from controlling it. Willis says the repair was complicated by miserable weather and more snow slides.
From the perspective of the folks that are on the mountain, the linemen, there was some terrible weather to work in. Those very cold, very windy days, that was really a difficult time for the crew out there. And then they were up there in the snow and so on, so they couldn't see each other, trying to do everything by radio. That was another difficult time. For those of us in town, the frustrating thing was we were just a few days away from getting the repairs complete, and we kept having these weather delays. And so that was very frustrating, knowing we were generating diesel just for the weather.
Meanwhile, a consulting engineer has been looking for alternatives to the avalanche-prone line. He will present those options to the Juneau Assembly tonight. Mayor Bruce Botello says each has a high cost to be balanced against the benefit of reducing risk along the line.
I guess my primary concern is to take whatever measures are reasonably necessary to minimize the risk of avalanche danger to the towers, the transmission lines, and balance it against the cost to achieve that reduction in level of risk. I mean, there is a cost benefit that has to be constantly calculated in.
Juneau residents have become accustomed to conservation. AELNP's Willis says electricity use is down about 18% over last year at this time. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, stocking up on goodies for the Yukon Quest Trail.
Freeze-dried cheesecake. And he had like all these freeze-dried, like, or, you know, gourmet meals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska. Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The state ferry Lituya sustained a gash in its hull as a result of Friday's grounding of the ferry off the coast of Metlakatla. Deanna Garrison of member station KRBD has this report.
During a heavy windstorm early Friday morning, the Lituya broke free from its mooring lines and drifted unattended about a mile and a half before grounding near Scrub Island. There were no people or pets aboard the vessel at the time. Crews were able to refloat the ferry Friday afternoon, and now it is awaiting repairs at the Ketchikan shipyard. Doug Ward is the director of shipyard development for Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. He says the Lituya will be put into dry dock as soon as crews are able to wrap up work on another state ferry, the Taku. State Department of Transportation spokesperson Roger Weatherall says a dive survey of the vessel has uncovered some damage.
We found that we did indeed have a damaged bilge keel cooler on the bottom and a destroyed bilge keel. There is also a hole in the bottom adjacent to the number four void. That's an isolated void. When they took a look in there, they found about 30,000 gallons of water, and that has completely been pumped out to this point. Once we get the vessel in the dry dock up out of the water, we'll be able to get a much better assessment of the damage.
Weatherall did not know just how large the hole is at this point. He says the Marine Highway is hoping to have the Lituya back in service by the end of this month. The state does not yet have a damage cost estimate. He says the Marine Highway and Coast Guard are in the process of investigating the incident.
Was it a freak act of nature? I don't know, but we'll look into it and we'll have our investigation. The Coast Guard will have theirs, and we'll put the two together, match up, and see what looks best.
While this case is unique, Weatherall says other Marine Highway ferries have had issues with mooring lines.
Other vessels have had lines part at the dock, but as far as lines parting and ships drifting and grounding, no. We don't have any known historical incidences of that nature. We've had lines part. It happened within the last 2 months, in fact.
The $9.7 million Lituya began operating in 2004. Metlakatla Mayor Carl Cook says the importance of the ferry to Metlakatla's residents cannot be underestimated.
We're pretty much stuck when we don't have that ferry on the island, you know, as far as car traffic and getting to and from the hospital and stuff like that. We pretty much have to depend on smaller boats to do emergency things then, you know.
The IFA ferries to Keene is filling in for the Lituya this month, providing five-day-a-week round-trip service between Ketchikan and Metlakatla. The Stikine's daily schedule between Hollis and Ketchikan remains unchanged. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Sim Smith pulled out a two-minute victory over defending champion Lance Mackey in the Tustamina 200 sled dog race over the weekend on the Kenai Peninsula. Smith's 12-dog team pulled into the Clamshell Lodge in Clam Gulch at 2:50 Sunday afternoon to finish in 19 hours, 8 minutes. Mackey and his 9-dog team came in at 2:52, followed by John Little, who finished third at 4:26 Sunday afternoon. Mackey had a 3-minute lead over Smith when the mushers stopped for their mandatory 8-hour layover over Saturday night, but Smith pulled ahead early Sunday and kept it for most of the last 50 miles. Smith, who also won in 2004, will get $6,000 for his victory. Icy trails caused the race to be delayed a week this year. It also forced a change in the route. Instead of an out-and-back run between Tustamina Lodge and Caribou Lake, this year teams made two round-trip trips between the Clamshell Lodge and the lake. Dean Osmar, who created the Tustamina 200 25 years ago, won the Tustamina 100, while Travis Beals won the 50-mile Junior T sled dog race. Final preparations for the Yukon Quest are underway. Over the weekend, participants in the 1,000-mile main event and shorter Quest 300 dropped off bags of race food and gear for distribution to checkpoints along the trail. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Running a long sled dog race isn't like mushing to the North Pole, but it is a major undertaking that requires thinking of everything you might need for 10 days to 2 weeks on the trail. Yukon Quest Fairbanks checkpoint manager Mark Winterstein says mushers pack the bags that will be distributed to checkpoints with a range of food and supplies.
The plastic runners for the sleds, replacement runners, and booties for the dogs, maybe spare harnesses, like what else? Dog food, of course, and snacks and treats and stuff like that. That's typically like the stuff they normally put. Oh, batteries for their headlamps. That's a pretty important one, too. Because they can't get any outside help, so they have to prepare ahead of time for all the stuff they'll need along the way.
Winterstein says some mushers are very particular about what they send out, like Quest veteran Bill Pinkham, whose bags carry some fancy cuisine.
Freeze-dried cheesecake. and he had like all these freeze-dried, like, or, you know, gourmet meals and stuff like that. And that was, I thought that was pretty cool. Like, he's eating pretty fancy on the trail.
Winterstein says on average, mushers drop off about 40 up to 40-pound bags each. He says they send as many as 10 bags to some checkpoints and as few as one to others. Quest veteran Dan Caduce of Chattanooga says the number and contents of bags reflect the running schedule mushers lay out for themselves before the race.
When you pack your drop bags, you kind of plan how long each of your runs are going to be. You're not really sure how long each of those are going to take, but you know how far you're going to go. So I just kind of work from there.
This year, mushers have tweaked their plans for the last part of the 1,000-mile race to reflect a change in the location of the final checkpoint. It's moving from Chena Hot Springs to Twin Bears Camp, chopping the final run from 100 miles to 55 miles. Because mushers are required to rest 8 hours at the last checkpoint, Gadu says strategies will likely change.
You're going to see teams doing fairly unheard-of runs to get to Twin Bears that wasn't happening in the past. Knowing that you had a nearly 100-mile run to the finish line, you wouldn't quite burn so hard to the last checkpoint. But now, knowing that you've just got a regular 50-plus-mile flat run to the finish line, people are going to, you know, potentially run a long ways to get there.
Caduce says he's hoping for a smooth run that allows him to stick to his pre-race plan and finish strong. But right now, he and other racers are just focused on readying for the start, February 14th in Whitehorse. The hundreds of supply bags mushers dropped off in Fairbanks Saturday and at a similar event in Whitehorse will be trucked and flown to checkpoints to await mushers along the trail. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Last week, the Bering Straits and Sitnasauk Native Corporations celebrated the arrival of commercial wind energy to Nome as they cut the ribbon on their new Banner Wind Farm. KNOM's John Francis has more.
At a public reception Thursday, BSNC President and CEO Tim Tewarik noted the wind farm could change the state's outlook on Bush Alaska and open new doors.
Rural Alaska always has made you feel like that they're a burden on the state of Alaska. Now that we've got an opportunity out here for the state to invest capital into help reducing the cost of energy, I'd like to challenge the state of Alaska to put more funds into rural Alaska like Bering Straits Native Corporation and Sitnasauk Native Corporation did.
Sitnasauk Vice President Neil Foster talked about why they got on board with the project.
Our involvement over at Sitnasauk has largely come because of the philosophy that Bering Straits has and the philosophy that Tim Tewarik has, and that is in wanting to reach out as the regional Native Corporation, reach out to the villages and establish a working relationship with the villages, and that's something that was really appreciated, and our joint venture has been just a great, great venture.
Western Community Energy's Brian Jackson gave a presentation on the 18-turbine farm from conception to completion to more than 100 people attending. Jackson said there are a number of incentives which are not limited to only cheaper energy.
What we see out of Banner, the key benefits is we expect to offset up to 200,000 gallons of diesel fuel a year with this project, with the energy that it contributes to the grid. Saving that fuel, you know, obviously a wonderful benefit. But the other benefits, it's not just the fuel savings, it's a tremendous amount of local jobs during the construction, the operations, the administration. We've got a long-term revenue stream. These turbines are designed for a 30-year life. We can rebuild them, we can change them, we can upgrade them over the time.
Jackson also said the ceremony acknowledges more than just Nome's wind farm.
What we're celebrating here with our dedication is this incredible beginning. Our real heart's desire is to get out to the villages and smaller communities where we feel like we can make a very big difference in those people's lives. We really firmly believe that if we didn't start with this project, we couldn't see a way that we could actually go to the villages and do that.
With 65 kilowatts generated by each of the 18 wind turbines, Nome's joint utility has already seen the demand on their diesel-powered generators drop since December. In Nome, I'm John Francis.
In Canada, wind energy would seem a natural fit for northern windy coastal communities. But the CBC's Jackie Sharkey reports, so far it's not lived up to its promise. She has this story on a wind energy project in Rankin Inlet.
Strong, steady winds are ideal conditions for a windmill, and something Rankin Inlet has got in spades. But since it was installed in 2000, the hamlet's windmill has barely budged. Mike Urima is with the Kudluk Energy Corporation.
The reason the windmill wasn't running was for safety reasons. We did not have access to repair the tip brakes, which was the problem why it wasn't running. The tip brakes prevent a windmill from overspeeding in high winds.
The tip brakes worked too well. They would activate even during ideal wind conditions, keeping the turbine from producing any power. Now that it's fixed, Rankin Inlet has the only working wind turbine in the territory. Cambridge Bay and Cougarook both had them, but Cougarook's was struck by lightning in 2000, and Cambridge Bay's collapsed 2 years later. Megan Bennett is the director of Nunavut's Energy Secretariat. She says in spite of these problems, wind power could still be an energy option for some communities.
It would become part of the bigger work that we're doing. We're looking at wind and all other alternative energy potentials for communities across Nunavut. Some of the plans for expanding, for example, looking at wind farms, would also have to take into account capital requirements.
Bennett says diesel wind hybrids could be in store for communities needing power plant upgrades, but no decisions have been made just yet on the future of wind power in Nunavut. Jackie Sharkey, Rankin Inlet.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Alaska Airlines 737 was struck by lightning on its approach to Sitka yesterday evening. All passengers disembarked in Sitka, and the plane went on to Juneau with only the flight crew. The plane sustained minor damage and was returned to service. The coastal area of southeast Alaska has experienced occasional thunderstorms for the past week. The National Weather Service in Juneau says the phenomenon, sometimes called thunder snow, occurs when cold air moves in over the relatively warm ocean. The resulting thermal circulation creates thunderheads. Although thunder snow is not all that unusual this time of year, it usually peaks in the autumn when ocean temperatures are at their warmest. Redoubt Volcano seems determined to keep Alaskans gripped in suspense. Alaska Volcano Observatory geologist Tina Neal says Redoubt remains in a heightened sense of unrest. She says an episode of high seismic activity on Saturday appeared to be the start of an eruption, but now the volcano is back in the waxing and waning pattern of tremor activity.
So all of this together means that the volcano is still displaying quite a bit of restlessness, and our interpretation at this time is that an eruption is still possible in a time frame of days to weeks. That's still our best consensus interpretation of the likely outcome.
Redoubt is about 100 miles southwest of Anchorage. Neal says volcanologists expect to see a sharp and prolonged increase in earthquake activity prior to an eruption.
So we will see a definite departure from this pattern if an eruption were imminent or occurring.
Neal says the tremor activity could continue on for days or weeks, resulting in an eruption or simply dying down. Alaska's pollock fishery is seeking recertification as a sustainable fishery from the Marine Stewardship Council, or MSC. The council provides independent third-party certification for fisheries around the world to ensure that they are not damaging the fish stocks or the surrounding ecosystem. MSC Regional Director for the Americas, Brad Ack, says a fishery is assessed based on three areas.
The standard breaks into three pieces: the health of the stock, the impacts of the fishery on the ecosystem, and the management system that's in place in order to maintain the sustainability of the fishery.
The assessment will be conducted by Moody Marine using data from government sources, peer-reviewed scientific data, and input from community and fishery stakeholders.
It's not NIMS defending its stock assessment, and it's not Greenpeace saying it's wrong. It's an independent body taking a look at all of that data and coming up with its own determination. And that's why the MSC has gained a lot of credibility in the international arena because it's that third-party look.
Ack says that's why seafood bearing the MSC label is highly valued throughout the world.
That designation has a lot of appeal in the marketplace with seafood buyers around the world who are trying to sort out the wheat from the chaff about competing claims of sustainability.
The pollock fishery first gained certification in 2005. Ack says the assessment process will be funded by the At-Sea Processors Association and will take about a year to complete. The size of the fishery, both in volume and area, as well as the important role pollock plays in the overall ecosystem, make the assessment process more complex than for other fisheries. Two major tourism industry groups say they have no plans to ask lawmakers to reduce or eliminate Alaska's cruise ship passenger fee. Some municipal leaders in Juneau and Ketchikan want the fee reexamined. They say dropping or shrinking the $50 per person charge would help a struggling industry. But Ron Peck of the Alaska Travel Industry Association says his group is not asking for a change. The same is true for John Binkley of the Alaska Cruise Association.
Well, we're not asking for anything specific in terms of the head tax legislation. There's no initiative that we've got or proposal that we've got before the legislature, and I don't even anticipate one this session.
The fee is part of the cruise ship initiative passed by voters in 2006. It also set new wastewater rules and established onboard environmental monitors. Industry groups are asking the legislature to loosen up the wastewater regulations. Some want the states to allow mixing zones which dilute ocean discharges. Otherwise, they say ships may sail outside state waters to avoid regulation. But initiative author Joe Geldof says the standards are reasonable and achievable.
The changes to diminish Alaska's water quality standards and the talks about rolling back the taxes, this is political hysteria generated in Miami and advanced by the lobbyists for the cruise ship companies. It's not good for the public, and I don't think the average citizen's going to buy it.
The depressed economy and competition from other regions are expected to cut into Alaska's summer tourist season. Cruise lines are heavily discounting rates to fill empty berths, and local tour operators are reporting low advanced sales. One small line, Cruise West, has significantly reduced this year's southeast sailings, and one large ship, the Serenade of the Seas, has canceled its 2010 Alaska route. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Casey Kelly in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, John Francis in Nome, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and the CBC's Jackie Sharkey. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.